We are speaking today with Eduardo Galeano. Eduardo Galeano is an Uruguayan novelist and journalist who made headlines recently when Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez gave President Barack Obama a copy of one of Galeano's books, The Open Veins of Latin America, Five Centuries of the Pillage of a Continent. He was born in Montevideo in 1940 and lived in exile in Argentina and Spain for years before returning to Uruguay. He is the author of nearly 40 books, translated into 28 languages, and the recipient of many international awards, including the first Lannan Prize for Cultural Freedom, the American Book Award, the Casa de las Americas Prize, and the first Distinguished Citizen of the Region by the countries of Mercosur. In addition to The Open Veins of Latin America, he is also best known for his trilogy, Memory of Fire. Also, Soccer in Sun and Shadow, The Book of Embraces, Days and Nights of Love and War, Upside Down, a primer for the looking glass world, and he is here to talk about his latest book, Mirrors, Stories of Almost Everyone. Eduardo Galeano, thank you very much for spending time with
us
today.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you.
Tell us, what was the motivation in writing your new book, Mirrors, Stories of Almost Everyone?
The book was growing inside me because books write me. They write me. I don't know how it works, but that's the way it is. They grow inside up to a certain point in which, a certain moment in which they knock at the door saying, I want to go out, I want to be in the streets, I want to reach people. And so I let them go. But it's an internal process, not always explainable. I was just writing short stories during years, and most of them became this book, Mirrors, 600 short stories. Others didn't find a place inside the book. But I didn't know I was writing the book, really. They were just short stories about everything. The idea was just to write with no boundaries, no frontiers. No frontiers in the map, no frontiers in time. And the title, Mirrors, I don't know, perhaps it came from the fact that the famous Argentinian writer, Jorge Luis Borges, hated mirrors because mirrors multiply people. He hated mirrors and sex because mirrors and sex multiplies people. And this is exactly the reason why I love both mirrors and sex.
Because they multiply people.
Yes, yes. I'm sure that each time I look at the mirror, there are a lot of people there. I'm not alone, because I am full of people. Everybody is full of people. There is not a single real lonely man or woman in the world. We are all full of people. Our memories is speaking, laughing, crying inside, never silent.
Well, speaking of women, stories of women feature prominently in your book, and as you pointed out in your talk, how can a group that is a majority be treated as a minority?
Yes, it's half of human population are women, and they are still called a minority. What I said was, well, I am not too strong in mathematics, but half of something cannot be a minority. And they have been mistreated all along the official history during millenniums and centuries, almost everywhere. And the books, the book, these mirrors, collects I don't know how many, but many stories about it, about women existing before they were officially recognized as persons. I was recently in Canada, now in Ottawa, and there I discovered that legally women were not persons until 1920 or until 20-something. Recently they were officially, legally recognized as persons. And this was also the job of official history, to suppress women as they made invisible entire peoples, black people, Native American Indians or Natives, Native Americans. And the south of the world and the east of the world, China, India, Africa, we don't know anything about Africa except what Professor Tarzan taught us.
And Africa being the birthplace of the world.
Africa, yes, the cradle. We all came from Africa. I say that in one of the stories in Mirrors, that perhaps Adam and Eve were blacks, because we are all African immigrants. All the experts coincide.
Mm-hmm. Concede.
Agree. Mm-hmm. All of them agree in this fact, that we all are African immigrants. We all came from Africa. Even the whitest of the whitest came from Africa. And perhaps we deny this fact, or we don't accept in our daily lives the idea that we are all African, African immigrants, because racism produces amnesia, and because perhaps it sounds unbelievable, the fact that the entire world was our kingdom when our ancestors began spreading all over the world, and the sun took care of the colors, and the only passport required was legs.
I learned in Sunday school in church as a child that Jesus was white.
Yes.
Did you learn that also?
Well, he was a Palestinian. I don't know, a Jewish in Palestina. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps he was not exactly white, but it doesn't matter, because he became much more than his personal biography, you know. It doesn't mind, really. And he was indeed a person quite different from his father. I'm terrified when I read the Bible. This God, terrible, angry, preaching violence and vengeance, and jealous, very jealous, which is for me a mystery, because he was supposed to be the only God, and never had sex, never made love. So how could he reproduce? It's one of the mysteries there. I had a very, very Catholic, deeply intense Catholic childhood and mystical. I wanted to become a priest. Can you imagine poor Holy Church? It said, because I wasn't able to be a saint for my natural tendency to sins. And I also, of course, as all Uruguayan child, all of them, I wanted to become also a football player, no? But I had wooden legs. I was terribly bad, and I could not go on. And later I wanted to be a painter and a designer. And it was not that bad, but there was always a sort of an abyss open between the desire and the world, what I wanted to do and what I could do. And finally, I began writing. It's the only thing that I more or less managed to do. It's my destiny, I suppose.
You paint with words.
Perhaps. It may be true, because you know that I cannot write anything if, closing my eyes, I'm not able to see it before I write it. I mean, I must see a story, even an idea. It has form, colors, sounds. I must see it, and later it becomes words. images that became words. It's always this is a process. If I'm not able to see it, I cannot write it. And this is part of my personal biography, because I wanted to be a painter, really, and I could not.
How were you as a student in school? You mentioned in your talk that you were expelled more than once.
I was terrible, because I was asking always uncomfortable questions, and also because I was bored. It was so boring being there, and we were obliged at that time to know by heart the exact dates of battles and the names of heroes, and it was a collection of attractions, possible attractions in any museum, but not in real life. And I hated history, especially. I'm not a historian nowadays, but nowadays I am able to recognize myself in others, people who were born far away from my country and far away from my time. But at that time it was absolutely impossible for me to imagine such a thing. And so my education was very short, my formal education. I went six years to the school, and less than 1 year to the secondary school, and that was all. And afterwards I worked, since I was almost a child, and I was very free, and I began learning the art of storytelling in the cafes of Montevideo. I'm son of the cafes, with all these anonymous storytellers sitting down in the cafes and telling stories, real or invented, and that's the way I learned. I learned to how to tell it, how to tell things, events, acts of imagination, how to transmit emotions with words. Some of them were masters in the art of storytelling, but I don't remember a single name, because they were absolutely anonymous. And they did it just for the pleasure of doing it. No? Like the best football players are doing it for the pleasure, not for the duty, not to earn money or fame, but just because it gives pleasure.
So you have combined the art of oral storytelling and writing together.
Yes, combine both, yes. And I enjoy telling stories with friends, or when I am in a cafe. I have my second home is a cafe in Montevideo called El Brasilero. And I enjoy telling stories, but overall I enjoy hearing stories. And I am a sort of a thief of stories, thief of words, thief of expressions, of any coming from any language. I hear something in French last week, and I adopted the word because I liked it, the expression. Contre-coeur. To do something à contre-coeur. Against your own heart, a contre-coeur. In Spanish it would be a contra-corazón. When you are doing something but you're not believing in it, not really believing in it, then it's, in English perhaps it's not possible to say it, but something like a counter-heart or against your own heart, but it probably loses the energy it has. As a French word. And I adopt a lot of words everywhere. Bébé morar. With friends, for instance. Some friends, time passed by, you recover them, you meet them again. How are you? Let's go to bébé morar. Bébé morar is a word came from Brazil. It's not Uruguayan. Portuguese expression, bebe morar, which means drink and remember. It's impossible to do it in English, bebe morar, but it means at once, let's drink and remember all together. It would be something like, let's drink memory, perhaps. Another word that I learned, perhaps I'm speaking too much, I don't know what, if you really want to know this sort of things, but when I was in Colombia, I was in Colombia several times, and it's a beautiful and friendly country. People think it's just a violent, terrible place where you cannot live, and it's not true at all. And with the fishermen at the coast, I was with a friend of mine who recently died, Orlando Falsborda, a great writer. And we both heard an expression invented by the fishermen there about language. They said that true language is a feel-thinking language. El lenguaje sentipensante, meaning the language able to join the mind and the heart at once. No?
So, do you think a lot of our problems in the world stem from not doing things that we feel are right in our heart?
Feeling, thinking, the divorce between the mind and the heart, the world of ideas and the world of feelings, is one of the divorces that are, I don't know, in contradiction with our human condition, because we have been divorced. Our feelings and our thoughts have been divorced by a culture that divorces everything it touches, the soul and the body, for instance, the beauty and the beast, the past and the present, your public existence and your intimate existence, words and facts, for instance, which is tragic in the political field, because it's very bad for democracy, this divorce of words and facts, what politicians promised in their campaigns and what they later do as they are in power, which is a usual divorce, deeds and words that they don't recognize each other when they cross in the streets. That's why they don't no se saludan, they don't greet each other.
It's true of our politicians, but what of our citizens, for instance, here in the U.S., where we are supposedly a democracy and the world empire? Don't our citizens have a responsibility, perhaps more than our leaders, to match our words and our deeds?
Yes, certainly, certainly. And it's easy to, you know, to send all the responsibility to the professionals of politics instead of practicing it as a daily engagement, as a daily responsibility. Yes, it's true. But this is also a divorce, the divorce between power and public, power and people. And it's true that people, especially young people, is feeling more and more that power is something not connected at all with their real lives. For instance, in Chile, I was amazed and very worried when I knew that in the last elections, a vast majority, almost 70% of young people, very young people, who were supposed to vote for the first time, didn't vote at all. They didn't get their inscriptions to become citizens able to vote, because they don't believe in it. They don't believe in it. And in this sense, yes, the fact that so many young people is losing the faith in democracy, or are not able to feel that democracy is also something that touches each one of them, of the youngs, deeply inside, they don't feel it, and it's not easy to get away to, but politicians have certainly the responsibility to try to do it, try to do something about it, because otherwise they would be working for the next military coup. I mean, it's hurting the prestige of democracy. Each time a politician went on promising paradise and later in power, he's doing exactly the opposite of what he was telling, he was saying. And then it's usual in everywhere, not only in Latin America, everywhere, to hear young people saying all politicians are liars and these sort of things. And unfortunately, sometimes they have reason. It's true.
Why don't you consider yourself a historian? It seems like your latest book, Mirrors, is critical pieces of history.
Yeah, but it's history. Sometimes it's coming and going from past to present, from present to past. And there are no boundaries between present and past. And historians are specialized in recovering past times. And I'm also, I have the same passion and curiosity for things happening nowadays. And for me, this way to try to get inside what happened before is just a way of be more related to the world in which I am living now, my present day world. So it's that feeling I had when I was a child, no? That history was just visiting a museum or being in touch with corpses. It ran away as soon as I realized that past is present also. And that's why mirrors also are called mirrors, not only because mirrors multiply people as sex do, but also because in the mirrors we can meet people who died centuries or millenniums ago and were born far away and recognizes in themselves the same, or hate them or love them. There was a friend of mine, a beloved friend of mine, a poet in Nicaragua called José Coronel Urtecho. He died, he was old. And I used to go to visit him. He lived in the frontier between Nicaragua and Costa Rica, at the border of a river. And we sat down sharing words and silence. And when I began writing, not this book, Mirrors, but that trilogy, Memory of Fire, which is closely related to Mirrors, just that Mirrors is about the world, and Memory of Fire was about America, the Americas, all of them. And I was working in the first volume. And so I told Don Jose, he asked me, what are you doing now, Eduardo? I said, I'm working in this project. And, you know, Jose, I don't know if I can tell the big history through the little one, watch the universe, the entire universe through a keyhole, without being subjective. I cannot have any objectivity in what I'm doing. I try to be as objective as I can, but I cannot. And he said something I never forget. I have never forgotten. I have never forgotten. My English improves. He said, don't worry about it. Objectivity is a lie. The human gaze is subjective, always subjective. And those who preach objectivity as a religion, they don't really want to be objective. They want to be objects, to be saved from human pain. And I don't want to be object.
You've seen many U.S. presidents come and go over the years. What do you think of what we've seen so far of the current words and deeds of President Obama?
Well, it's soon to do a balance or to have an idea of, I mean, just the beginning of something and in the worst possible conditions. I wouldn't like to be in his shoes. Poor Obama. he got the presidency inside the worst crisis since 1929. I don't know if this one is not even worse than the other one. So it's soon to know. Let's see what happens. Anyway, the fact that the United States have a president, black or half black, is for me is a source of hope in the long fight against racism in the world, because this country had, well, in mirrors I tell a lot of stories of discrimination of black people in the States, humiliation and so on, which are not far away in time, not at all. Recent stories, for instance, one in 1942, they are almost all unknown or almost unknown stories. In 1942, when the United States was entering in the war, in the Second World War, the plasma, the blood transfusions were already saving millions and millions of lives in the battlefields. And this was not exactly the invention, but at least the man who could find a way to make transfusions without any danger, and he collected a lot of experience accumulated during years and years and years, and he got it. He got the way to save lives, keeping human blood in the banks of blood. His name was Charles Drew, and he became, this scientist became, the first director of the Red Cross in the United States, of the part of the plasma, of the blood transfusions. He was the director, and in 1942 the Pentagon sent an order forbidding the transfusion of blood, black blood. And he was the director of this service, this organization, and he denied to obey the order of the Pentagon, saying, the fact is that black blood doesn't exist. All blood are red. There is not such a thing as... He was going beyond that. He said, it's stupid to think that there exists such a thing as black blood. And so he resigned, or was resigned, I don't know. I forgot to tell you that Charles Drew was black. He was black. And so this happened 15 minutes ago. I mean, in historical terms, half a century is nothing, no? And so I think the fact that Obama is president means a lot.
Well, with that, we're out of time. I'd like to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Mike. I felt so... It was such a pleasant conversation that I forgot absolutely that we were in a radio studio.
Thank you. We've just been talking with Eduardo Galeano, author of the new book, Mirrors, Stories of Almost Everyone.